Tired of boring lunches? Picture this. You're at Chipotle ordering the same old burrito bowl. But wait, there's more excitement in store than just guac. Introducing Drop, the ultimate rewards app. Just link your card, dine at your favorite restaurants, and you'll earn points to get free gift cards from tons of brands. It's like getting paid to eat. Hungry for savings? Download the Drop app now and use code DROP44 to kickstart your rewards journey with $5 in points.
Maybe you've noticed that when it comes to business, the people who succeed tend to be the people who seek out partners with skills or knowledge that they don't have. And that's what Lenovo's free online membership program, Lenovo Pro, can do for small businesses. If you're not a tech expert, that's where Lenovo can help. So you can add Lenovo's team to yours and then lean on them for all your tech questions for free. So to join Lenovo Pro, visit Lenovo.com and unlock new AI experiences with Lenovo's ThinkPad X1 Carbon powered by Intel Core Ultra Processors.
Hey everyone, it's Ted from Consumer Cellular, the guy in the orange sweater, and this is your wake-up call. If you're paying too much for wireless service, you don't have to keep having that nightmare. Consumer Cellular has the same fast, reliable coverage as the leading carriers for up to half the cost. So why keep spending more than you have to? Seriously, wake up and call 1-888-FREEDOM or visit ConsumerCellular.com.
Savings based on cost of Consumer Cellular single line 1, 5, and 10 gig data plans with unlimited talk and text compared to lowest cost single line postpaid unlimited talk, text, and data plans offered by T-Mobile and Verizon January 2024.
Hey there, history fans. We're taking the day off, but don't worry. We've got plenty of classic shows to tide you over. Please enjoy these flashback episodes from the TDI-HC Vault. Hello, and welcome to This Day in History Class, a show that uncovers a little bit more about history every day. I'm Gabe Lousier, and today, we're looking at the story behind one of the most polarizing summer fashions of all time. You can love it or loathe it, but the one thing you can't do is ignore it. The day was July 5th, 1946. French designer Louis Riard introduced the world to the bikini. The revealing two-piece bathing suit made its debut at a poolside fashion show at the Piscine Molitor Hotel Complex in Paris. It was modeled by Micheline Bernardini, an exotic dancer at a local casino who had agreed to wear the skimpy outfit after all the professional models in town refused. The swimsuit's unveiling was considered quite scandalous at the time, which is ironic when you consider that women had already worn bikini-like garments in public nearly 2,000 years earlier. Roman mosaics from the 4th century depict ancient female athletes wearing two-piece outfits as early as 1400 BC. It's true those garments wouldn't have been worn to go swimming, but that's just because all Romans, men and women alike, always swam in the nude. By the turn of the 20th century, though, many European cultures had gotten much more prudish about showing skin in public, especially when it came to women. Victorian women, for example, wore big, loose-fitting bathing costumes that left pretty much everything to the imagination. In fact, the culture was so obsessed with concealing the female form that it even devised a special vehicle to roll women into the water unseen. Known simply as a bathing machine, the device was basically a wooden cart with a little enclosed hut on top, the roof and walls of which were made from either solid wood or canvas. A female swimmer would enter the machine fully clothed, and then change into her bathing costume once the curtains had been drawn. Then, the whole apparatus would be wheeled into the water by a horse, or less commonly by a human. The woman inside would then exit the machine on the seaside, walk down a few steps, and wade into the water. She was then free to enjoy the waves and fresh air, provided, of course, that she remained in line with her bathing machine, so that she couldn't be seen by those on the shore. Thankfully, the dress code at the beach loosened a great deal in the decades that followed. The baggy one-piece suits of old gave way to midriff-bearing two-pieces, beginning in the early 1930s. Modesty remained a top concern, though, with most bathing suits consisting of a halter top and a pair of shorts-like trunks. That design became slightly more revealing during World War II, when the rationing of fabric led to the removal of some excess material, though care was still taken to ensure a woman's navel would remain staunchly covered. Beyond that, swimsuit design didn't change much during the war, especially in Europe, where many beaches and coastlines became sites of battle instead of leisure. All of that changed, though, in 1946, when Western Europeans hit the beach for their first post-war summer. It was during this time that two competing male fashion designers came up with a barely-there swimsuit to reflect the relaxed mood in Europe. First on the scene was Jacques Haim with his two-piece design known as the Atom, after the smallest particle of matter. True to its name, the Atom was billed as the world's smallest bathing suit. However, Haim wasn't able to make that claim for long, as his rival, Louis Riard, was about to debut a significantly smaller outfit. His design used just 30 inches of fabric, essentially just four small triangles and a couple of strings. Riard dubbed his creation the Bikini as a timely reference to the Bikini Atoll, the Pacific island chain where the U.S. military had begun testing nuclear weapons just a few days prior to the swimsuit's debut. It may seem bizarre that both Haim and Riard would name their swimsuits after something so devastating, but at the time, atomic energy still held a lot of promise for the public. It had already found its way into pop culture, too. Attractive women were commonly described as bombshells, and anything extreme or exciting was called atomic. Riard tapped into that cultural zeitgeist by creating a swimsuit that he described as, quote, just as explosive as the atomic bomb. Riard was preparing to debut the bikini at a popular public swimming pool in Paris when he ran into a slight snag. None of the local professional models would agree to wear such a revealing swimsuit. They worried that appearing nearly nude in public would cause a scandal and possibly ruin their careers. This led Riard to hire Micheline Bernardini, a dancer from the Casino de Paris, who didn't share the model's misgivings. In a final stroke of self-promotion, Riard printed newspaper type all over the bikini that Bernardini modeled on July 5th. This was meant as a nod to the torrent of headlines that his new swimsuit was sure to inspire. Following its debut, the bikini became an international sensation, and so did Bernardini. She reportedly received about 50,000 fan letters after the fashion show, most of which were from men. Not long after, bikinis started popping up all along the Mediterranean coast, eventually prompting Spain and Italy to ban the skimpy two-piece from their beaches. They, of course, relented a few years later once bikinis had become a staple of European shores. By the 1950s, other fashion designers had rolled out their own versions of the bikini, though Riard cautioned the public to accept no imitations. According to him, a two-piece bathing suit wasn't a true bikini unless it was small enough to be pulled through a wedding ring. Skeevy marketing aside, the bikini was a massive hit in post-war Europe. The same couldn't be said for the US, though, where it was initially dismissed as a risque trend. For example, Modern Girl magazine claimed that, quote, it is hardly necessary to waste words over the so-called bikini, since it is inconceivable that any girl with tact and decency would ever wear such a thing. That view persisted until the early 1960s, when Hollywood stars and California surfing culture finally put an end to the taboo. To mark the occasion, pop singer Brian Hyland even gave the swimsuit its very own theme song, Itsy Bitsy Teeny Weeny Yellow Polka Dot Bikini.
It was an itsy bitsy teeny weeny yellow polka dot bikini that she wore for the first time today. An itsy bitsy teeny weeny yellow polka dot bikini, so in the water she wanted to stay.
From that point on, the bikini has only grown in popularity, though it still has plenty of detractors, some of whom think it promotes the objectification of women, which is certainly the case in some crowds. But whatever your personal convictions may be, I think we can all agree that showing a lot of skin is still preferable to using horse-drawn carts to wheel fully clothed women into the sea. Or at least, I hope we can all agree on that. these days, you can never really tell. I'm Gabe Lousier, and hopefully you now know a little more about history today than you did yesterday. If you'd like to keep up with the show, consider following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at TDIHCShow. And if you have any comments or suggestions, feel free to send them my way at thisday@iheartmedia.com. Thanks to Chandler Mays for producing the show, and thank you for listening. I'll see you back here again tomorrow for another day in history class.
Maybe you've noticed that when it comes to business, the people who succeed tend to be the people who seek out partners with skills or knowledge that they don't have. And that's what Lenovo's free online membership program, Lenovo Pro, can do for small businesses. They have the resources and expertise to help you make big tech decisions. As a small business owner, you understand more than anyone that any decision can make or break your business. That's where Lenovo Pro can help, especially if you're not a tech expert yourself. They can keep up with the latest tech trends like AI and help you save money on the smartest tech solutions for your business. And by joining Lenovo Pro, you can enjoy a long-term partnership focused on helping your business take advantage of every tech opportunity in the future. So you can add Lenovo's team to yours and then lean on them for all your tech questions for free. So to join Lenovo Pro, visit Lenovo.com. That's Lenovo.com. And unlock new AI experiences with Lenovo's ThinkPad X1 Carbon, powered by Intel Core Ultra Processors.
So, should we go electric?
I think we should go electrified with Toyota.
Electrified?
Electrified means options. Yes, we could go all electric with a Toyota bZ4X, but then there are hybrids like Grand Highlander, or we could do something in between like a RAV4 plug-in hybrid.
So, Toyota is electrified diversified?
Yep, and with more options for reducing carbon emissions, the closer we all get to Toyota's Beyond Zero vision for the future.
Exactly how much coffee have you had this morning?
Learn more about our Beyond Zero vision for the future at toyota.com/beyondzero.
You never want to find yourself out on the water fishing without the essentials. So it's best to always pack a Columbia PFG Solar Stream Elite hoodie to protect against the sun. I mean, it provides great protection and it's really breathable so you don't get hot. That's a win-win. Columbia PFG has a lot of great gear. So before you head out on the water, head over to Columbia.com/PFG to shop their performance fishing gear.
Hello and welcome to This Day in History Class, a show that explores the ups and downs of everyday history. I'm Gabe Lousier, and in this episode, we're talking about how the Hawaiian Kingdom became a territory of the United States. And spoilers, it wasn't by choice. The day was July 7, 1898. President William McKinley signed a joint resolution annexing the Hawaiian Islands to the United States. Previously, Hawaii had been recognized internationally as a sovereign nation under the rule of Queen Liliuokalani, and it may very well have retained that sovereignty if not for the creeping influence of Sanford Dole and his fellow American businessmen. The first known settlers of the Hawaiian Islands were Polynesian voyagers who migrated there sometime in the 8th century. The original native society developed around a caste system and was eventually divided into four distinct chiefdoms: Hawaii, Maui, Oahu, and Kauai. In 1810, about 1,000 years after the first people's arrival, King Kamehameha I united those chiefdoms into a single royal kingdom, which he then ruled himself until his death in 1819. That same year, Hawaii welcomed the first Protestant missionaries who had come from the U.S. and England in hopes of converting the Hawaiians to Christianity. In the decades that followed, they established churches and congregations throughout the Hawaiian Islands, gradually changing the culture and religious life of the people who lived there. In the 1830s, the westernization of Hawaii was kicked into high gear by the arrival of American business investors. Lured by the promise of fertile volcanic soil and an ideal climate, wealthy American planters bought up large tracts of lands on the islands and began planting non-native cash crops, such as coffee, sugar cane, and pineapple. The resulting plantations changed Hawaii's economy through the introduction of capitalist systems, such as private land ownership, taxation, and wage labor. In recognition of the many rapid changes the islands had undergone in just a few short decades, King Kamehameha III voluntarily gave up his absolute power in 1840. The king remained the ceremonial head of the new constitutional monarchy, but from then on, he worked with a house of nobles and a house of tenants who represented the citizens. One of the king's first major acts under this new system was to send delegations to the U.S. and Europe in 1842. He did this to help shore up Hawaii against foreign invasion by establishing the island's presence as a sovereign kingdom. The mission succeeded the following year when many of the world's major powers, the U.S. included, signed treaties recognizing Hawaiian independence. Unfortunately, America's businessmen made no such acknowledgement themselves. Hawaii's fertile soil and close proximity to the states had long made it a tempting target for a coup, and in the late 19th century, Sanford Dole and his fellow plantation owners attempted just that. If the name Dole sounds familiar, it's probably because of the Dole Food Company, the world-famous pineapple producer that's largely responsible for that fruit's presence in Hawaii today. The company's founder, Sanford Dole, had made a fortune in Hawaii in the mid-1800s, and as a way to exert even more control over the islands, he partnered with other American businessmen and lawyers to form the so-called Hawaiian League. In 1887, the group sent an armed militia to force Hawaii's king, David Kalakaua, to sign a new constitution. Known as the Bayonet Constitution, it transferred most of the monarchy's power to the legislature, a ruling body whose elections were rigged in favor of white interests. 4 years later, King Kalakaua died and was succeeded by his sister, Queen Liliuokalani. After taking the throne, she actually refused to honor the Bayonet Agreement and tried to revise the constitution to return power to the monarchy. As you might imagine, though, Sanford Dole and his cohorts weren't happy about that development. So in January of 1893, Dole organized a so-called Committee of Safety and then laid in wait near the Queen's Palace. They were soon joined there by 300 Marines from the USS Boston, who had been called in to protect Dole's committee by the U.S. Minister of Hawaii, John L. Stevens. The action marked a turning point in the businessmen's struggle for control of the Hawaiian government, as the presence of U.S. Marines provided tacit government approval for Dole's coup. It also left Queen Liliuokalani with no choice but to surrender in order to avoid a full-blown war. The Queen held out hope for years that the U.S. government would come to its senses and recognize Hawaii's sovereignty once more. But as you likely know, that never happened. President Benjamin Harrison liked the idea of annexing the Hawaiian Islands after the coup, but after losing his bid for re-election in 1893, the final decision fell to his successor, Grover Cleveland. In 1894, an impatient Sanford Dole asked President Cleveland for permission to proceed with the annexation of Hawaii. Instead, though, Cleveland called for a special investigation into Dole's bloodless coup, and it was soon determined that Queen Liliuokalani had been overthrown illegally. In response, the president ordered the American flag to be lowered from all Hawaiian government buildings. He also recommended that the queen be restored to her throne, but Dole flatly refused. By that point, he and the safety committee had already established a provisional government in Hawaii. And instead of giving up that power, Dole doubled down by proclaiming Hawaii a republic and installing himself as its first president. It was a deeply troubling turn of events for native Hawaiians, especially since the rest of the world was just sitting by watching the coup unfold. Even the U.S. president had admitted the takeover was illegal. Looking back on the ordeal, President Cleveland later wrote that, quote, "The provisional government owes its existence to an armed invasion by the United States. By an act of war, a substantial wrong has been done." To the nation's great shame, that wrong was never corrected. President Cleveland was unwilling to overthrow Dole's government by force, and his successor, William McKinley, eventually negotiated a treaty with the Republic of Hawaii, lending further legitimacy to Dole's rule. In response, the island's native inhabitants organized to assert Hawaiian independence. They mounted multiple rebellions and signed numerous petitions in protest of annexation, sometimes garnering signatures from more than half of the island's indigenous population. The people of Hawaii were clearly opposed to annexation, but in the end, their consent was deemed unnecessary. American leaders had flirted with annexation for some time, but never felt fully justified in claiming the islands as U.S. territory. That finally changed in early 1898 with the outbreak of the Spanish-American War. Part of the conflict was set to be fought in the Philippine Islands, and the congressmen who supported annexation were quick to point out the strategic utility of the Hawaiian Islands as a mid-Pacific fueling station and naval base. The argument proved convincing, and on June 15, 1898, the House of Representatives passed the so-called New Lands Resolution with a simple majority vote of 209-91. Then, 3 weeks later, the Senate passed it as well by a vote of 42-21. And on July 7th, President McKinley signed it into law, making the annexation of Hawaii official. In case you're wondering, that action did nullify Sanford Dole's power as the President of the Republic of Hawaii. However, it hardly mattered, as he was immediately reinstated as the first governor of the newly formed territory of Hawaii. Over the course of the next 50 years, Native Hawaiians endeavored to make the best of their situation by working to achieve statehood and the full rights of citizenship. There were numerous setbacks and painful losses along the way, but in 1959, Hawaii finally joined the Union as the nation's 50th state. A bittersweet victory, to be sure. I'm Gabe Lussier, and hopefully, you now know a little more about history today than you did yesterday. You can learn even more about history by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at TDIHCShow. And if you have any comments or suggestions, you can always send them my way by writing to thisday@iheartmedia.com. Thanks to Chandler Mays and Ben Hackett for producing the show, and thanks to you for listening. I'll see you back here again soon for another day in history class.
This is Malcolm Gladwell from Revisionist History. eBay Motors is here for the ride. With some elbow grease, fresh installs, and a whole lot of love, you transformed 100,000 miles and a body full of rust into a drive that's all your own. Brake kits, LED headlights, whatever you need, eBay Motors has it. And with eBay Guaranteed Fit, it's guaranteed to fit your ride the first time, every time, or your money back. Plus, at these prices, you're burning rubber, not cash. Keep your ride or die alive at ebaymotors.com. Eligible items only. Exclusions apply.
Maybe you've noticed that when it comes to business, the people who succeed tend to be the people who seek out partners with skills or knowledge that they don't have. And that's what Lenovo's free online membership program, Lenovo Pro, can do for small businesses. If you're not a tech expert, that's where Lenovo can help. So you can add Lenovo's team to yours and then lean on them for all your tech questions for free. So to join Lenovo Pro, visit Lenovo.com and unlock new AI experiences with Lenovo's ThinkPad X1 Carbon powered by Intel Core Ultra Processors.
So, should we go electric?
I think we should go electrified with Toyota.
Electrified?
Electrified means options. Yes, we could go all electric with a Toyota bZ4X, but then there are hybrids like Grand Highlander, or we could do something in between like a RAV4 plug-in hybrid.
So Toyota is electrified diversified?
Yep, and with more options for reducing carbon emissions, the closer we all get to Toyota's Beyond Zero vision for the future.
Exactly how much coffee have you had this morning?
Learn more about our Beyond Zero vision for the future at toyota.com/beyondzero.